This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger joins us to discuss this year's increased pace of fundraising by political action committees in Michigan. But first, how can we make sure everyone on Earth has enough to eat? It's a question scientists have been pondering since the world population topped 7 billion in 2011. It's expected to reach 9.6 billion by 2050. While many researchers focus on how to increase crop yields, Mike Klug, a retired microbial ecologist from Michigan State University, says we should be looking at the ground. Klug says we're losing soil at a rapid rate. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the world has already lost one-third of its usable soil. Klug will give a talk on vanishing soil communities Thursday at Pierce Cedar Creek Institute. WMUK's Rebecca Thiel visited Mike Klug at his home in Delton.
The estimate is around 900 million are undernourished. Food costs are rising on a global basis, maybe not so much in the United States, but they certainly are in other areas. And the arable soil is now known to have plateaued. We now know it takes about 1.4 hectares of soil to feed individuals. With the loss of arable soils, the question is, are we going to have enough arable soil to support that added population by 2050?
You say you get a little riled up when people call soil dirt. Why?
Dirt, I always describe dirt as something that you sweep out of the corners of your kitchen. So it has very little life associated with it, first of all, and it has very little structure to it. And soils have structure to it. It is a intricate relationship between the mineral, the organic, and the microbial and invertebrate populations, which provide structure to the soil environment. And so there are many, they say, we probably started with dirt at the beginning of the formation of the earth. We then began to form soils that existed for millions of years, and now the major question is are we returning more towards dirt, because we're losing the structure, we're losing components within the food web. The other aspect of this is that there's been some very, very interesting studies from around the world which have shown the benefits of eating crops which have been grown in soil, healthy soil, versus degraded soils. Because those foodstuffs that are removed from healthy soil have an associated microbiology that is now known to be quite healthy for us to be ingesting. And a recent paper that was just published, a recent book which actually came out, is titled The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids with Food Straight from the Soil. The point being is that studies are now coming out that children that are living out in rural areas are exposed to a much higher diversity of organisms than children that are living in a more urban setting. We've become more of a sanitized world, and as a result of it, we are not getting the exposure to the diversity of organisms that we once did when we were out playing in the soil, so to speak.
Klug says plants feed nutrients to the soil and its helpful microbes. But when humans evolved from hunter-gatherers to farmers, we started taking more plants out of the soil than we were putting back in.
So does that, the constant removal of organic matter over the years, which has caused considerable loss of nutrition to the soil, and the fact that in many agricultural practices, we leave the soil bare for a certain period of time because we're growing annual crops. And during that period when the soil is bare, a combination of wind and water erosion is gradually eroding away the top surface of soil, which contains the majority of the biological activity.
Yeah, and, you know, when we were talking before, you said that this is the main reason why we have to add so much fertilizer.
That's right. If you do not have the biological community transforming that original organic matter back into nutrients, we have to supply more and more fertilizer and, in many cases, water in order to maintain the productivity that we need to basically feed the population that we have today.
You know, talking a little bit about erosion, you know, we all know that erosion isn't good, but we're not taking this as seriously. But you say that this is as disastrous as something like a tornado.
David Montgomery, who is a well-known geomorphologist from the University of Washington, has said that wind erosion sort of nickels and dimes you to death, in that it occurs, it is continuously occurring, but it occurs at such a slow rate that people don't take notice of it.
And wind erosion being, you know, when there's bare dirt or something
whenever
like that.
Whenever there's surface soil, surface dry soils, and of course the Dust Bowl of the 30s is probably the best example of wide-scale wind erosion. Last year there was considerable wind erosion out in the Nevada and Arizona due to the arid, droughty areas out there. But around here, we notice it periodically, but we don't take really good notice of it because it occurs at such a low rate. Water erosion, of course, is a little bit more dramatic in that you can move a tremendous amount of soil in a short period of time. And I'm sure that we've all seen that in our own yards where we see soil moved at a very high rate with water erosion. And, of course, the consequences of erosion is that soil that's been removed either by wind or water is going to go someplace. And very often it goes into receiving waters, the rivers and lakes. And, of course, it has fostered an industry of dredging, continuous dredging, in order to keep those waterways open.
You said that one of the ways to stop this problem is to encourage ordinary people, as well as, I assume, farmers, mm-hmm. to plant native plants.
So the native plant is going to provide nectar and pollen sources for a variety of pollinators, the bees and the butterflies and things of that nature. But more importantly, the insects serve as food for almost all of our songbirds, because they feed their young insect larvae. So without the insect larvae, the birds obviously are going to have a difficult time of feeding their young ones with high protein, high lipid sources, which is, of course, a larval stage of an insect is. So that's another reason. The other reason is that these plants have evolved over a long period of time survival mechanisms, and one of them is to develop very extensive root systems. So the root systems go down many meters into the soil, and as a result of it, they're scavenging nutrients and they're scavenging water from great distances in the soil, and therefore they require very little maintenance after they've actually become established. So those are three reasons. The other is, and I may have already mentioned this, but the fact that there is such an array of native plants that from your very early spring flowering plants, some of which are flowering almost while the snow is still on the ground, to things like asters, which are present even after frost. So there's a continuous supply of nectar and pollen throughout the entire season if you have a high diversity of native plants. And the main thing is the importance of diversity of plant material so that you're supporting a large array of insects and providing the necessary resources for those insects over time.
Now, you were talking about the root system of native plants, mm-hmm. you know, going farther down into the earth so they're more able to get mm-hmm. nutrients, they're more able to get water. How does this differ from, you know, say, a corn crop that we've just planted?
Well, very often in annual crops, plant breeders, of course, are most interested in breeding what we're actually going to be consuming, which is the above-ground portion. This obviously is not true of carrots, but as a result of it, there isn't as much attention given to the root system because modern agricultural and gardening practices, we're always adding something to the soil, so the plant really doesn't have to do a lot of mining. We're providing the nutrients that it needs on the surface in those relatively shallow rooting systems. The downfall of that, of course, is that they're going to require additional water because the root system does not go down as deep as the native plants do.
When we take plants out of the ground, we don't have those nutrients anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, is composting in some ways a solution to adding those nutrients back?
Composting on a small scale certainly is an option. In other words, anything we can do to add organic matter back into the soil is certainly going to be an advantage. The difficulty is that there probably would not be enough compost to support all of the agricultural activity that's going to be needed to support food production for the future populations. So there are other means of doing it, and one of which is cover crops. In other words, after the annual crop is removed, another crop is put in, which then is reincorporated into the soil the following spring, and then the new crop comes online. Two advantages of that is you're adding organic matter to the soil, and the second is that you're covering the soil and reducing erosion that would occur during the winter period of time.
So can you give us some examples of cover crops that farmers could use in this way?
Well, clovers, of course, are good for nitrogen fixation, and the high biomass ones are things like Sudan grass. In the wintertime, winter rye is very commonly used. During the summertime, on our garden rotation, we use oats and field peas, so we get both biomass and we get some nitrogen fixation from it.
So, you know, say that you aren't a farmer. What can you do to help the soil?
And basically, all of the things we have just talked about. In other words, trying to do some crop rotation in your gardens, leaving some portion of your garden fallow with a cover crop. Try to increase the organic matter content. Try to use either organic or very low input vegetable gardening. So try to reduce the amount of fertilization which you use. Never leave your soil bare, so that you're not going to encourage erosion. Reduce the use of herbicides and pesticides, which have a detrimental effect on beneficial insects. And also try to buy more of your produce and your animal biomass locally, where you know exactly the practices that producer is using, rather than buying it from large organizations where you're not quite sure exactly how that food is produced. And as I say, as far as benefits to your entire landscape is the use of planting of native plants, which also benefit your vegetable production because they also are encouraging beneficial insects, which are going to aid your vegetable production and, of course, significantly increase your pollination of your vegetable or fruit crops.
Mike Klug, thank you so much for talking with me.
Sure. It was a pleasure.
Hired MSU microbial ecologist Mike Klug will talk about vanishing soil communities Thursday at 11:30 at Pierce Cedar Creek Institute in Hastings. To register, follow the link on our website, wmuk.org. We'll be right back. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. By one measure, the 2016 election is shaping up to be a very expensive one. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network finds that the state's biggest political action committees, or PACs, are on pace to set a record for spending in a presidential election year. Craig Mauger is director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So explain to us, what does the activity surrounding political action committees right now, how does that compare with 2012?
Yeah, so basically in April, we had new reports on campaign fundraising come in for political action committees. So these are committees that usually represent interest groups, are connected to corporations, connected to labor unions, also raise money for lawmakers to spend on other races across the state. And what we've seen in the second quarter of 2016 is a record fundraising pace. So the top 150 Michigan PACs have raised $26 million so far this cycle. So that's from the last election in 2014 to April 20th in 2016. So they've raised $26 million so far, and that is a 17% increase over where the same list, it's a different list, but the top 150 PACs of 2012, where they were at the same point in 2012. At that point, the 150 PACs, the biggest 150, were at $22.2 million. So it's quite an increase. And 26 for this current cycle is the biggest we've seen in a presidential election cycle.
And we should make a point here that we compare presidential election cycles as opposed to, say, 2 years ago. We're comparing 2016 to 2012 rather than 2014 because the dynamics of the election are different.
The dynamics are different. So in gubernatorial cycles, which are 2014, 2010, there are more races on the ballot in Michigan, governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and 38 state senate seats. So those tend to draw more money. But actually, the 2016 pace that we're seeing when it comes to fundraising is still higher than every other cycle, even gubernatorial, except one, 2014. That's the last cycle. There was $32 million raised by the biggest PACs at this point in 2014. And the dynamic is very different because in gubernatorial years, we see a lot of out-of-state PACs set up in Michigan to flood money into the gubernatorial races and the attorney general races, and those PACs bring millions upon millions of dollars just in themselves, and then they kind of go away in the years when there's not a governor's race on the ballot.
Does this indicate that both Republicans and Democrats are looking at the state house as potentially being in play this year, that control of state house by one party or another could be determined by this fall's election?
I think the expectation around Lansing from people that I talk to is that this is going to be a very expensive battle for the state house in 2016, and that very much so the majority control of the chamber is very much in play. Right now, the Republicans have 63 of the seats of the 110 seats, so Democrats would have to win back 9 of them. And there's an expectation among many people that the Democrats will come very close to that number of 9. Whether they get to 9 is the question. Whether they will be close, the expectation is that, yes, they will be close at the end of the day.
When we look at these PACs that are raising money, which ones are bringing in the biggest haul right now, raising the most cash?
Yeah, it's a lot of familiar names are on the list for the cycle so far. First off, you have the caucus committees. So these are entities, these are committees that raise money to spend on their caucus races. So like the House Republicans, they have a campaign committee that tries to get House Republicans elected. So the House Republicans, Senate Republicans, the House Democrats, and the Senate Democrats are the biggest fundraisers so far. When it comes to interest groups, Blue Cross Blue Shield is perennially one of the top PACs. Their PAC is number 5. The Realtors Association is up there. The Michigan Beer and Wine Wholesalers are up there. The Regional Council of Carpenters is up there. The Health and Hospital Association, DTE. These are familiar names of groups that constantly have issues before the legislature, and they raise a lot of money and give to a lot of candidates. A lot of these groups give to candidates on both sides of the aisle. Some of them give to almost everybody in the legislature.
So we're talking right now about money raised. Any idea yet where that money is going to end up being spent?
The assumption is that this money will end up being given to a lot of those state house candidates across Michigan and probably, you know, sitting state senators, other office holders in Michigan, like the governor, potential governor candidates, I should say, the attorney general's PAC candidate committee will get some of this money. There's just a lot of possibilities.
Obviously, the caucus committees, we would expect those to spend very heavily on state house races. Some of these other PACs, which are raising a lot of the money, could they weigh their options, I guess? Could they look around and say, oh, boy, maybe it looks like the control of the state house isn't necessarily in play like we thought it was going to be, and say, well, there's this congressional race that looks interesting to us. We'd rather funnel our money there.
I mean, they would have to do that through their PACs on a federal level. I mean, primarily these PACs that are filing in Michigan and the numbers that we're reporting on primarily and generally will be used at the state level. And then a lot of these entities have federal PACs that raise money as well and will give to those federal candidates. It's a little bit different of a ball game. I think something you mentioned that's pretty interesting is that a lot of these PACs will be making the calculation of who will be in control of the House when 2017 rolls around, and they'll try to give more money to the people they think will win the races. So that's always an interesting thing to watch as well.
So that's a couple perhaps competing desires on behalf of someone who's trying to figure out where to donate. One may be to try to influence the race and help a candidate who they think would be helpful to them. But the other may be to simply back the winner because they wish to ingratiate themselves with them once that person's going to be in office.
Yeah, those are the two main strategies. And the other strategy is just if you have a lot of money, just to give to everyone to cover all your bases.
So there is some legislation which has been proposed in Lansing which would limit the amount that PACs could give to candidates. Explain kind of the nitty-gritty here. What does this bill actually do?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was introduced last month. It has bipartisan co-sponsors, three Republicans and a group of Democrats also co-sponsor it. And it would basically cut in half the maximum amount that PACs can give to candidates. And kind of the argument these lawmakers are making, which is a fascinating one, is that right now in Michigan law, if you're a political action committee, you can give 10 times the amount that a regular citizen can give. So a constituent of a lawmaker can give one amount. If it's a state house member, for instance, a constituent who lives in that house member's district can give that house member $1,000 during a cycle. A political action committee can give that House member $10,000, 10 times that amount. So the argument here from these lawmakers, a few of them which I talked to, is that it's not fair that a political action committee has that much more sway than the people who actually vote and choose who these House members are going to be. So they put forth a bill to cut in half that multiplier of 10 and cut it down to 5. It's a really fascinating proposal, not likely to be one that sees much traction in the legislature, which just voted to raise all the contribution limits in 2013. But it's a really interesting one, and it's also fascinating to hear lawmakers, this group, kind of speak out and say, we think PACs and interest groups have too much influence right now.
As you noted, this is a bipartisan group of lawmakers, a combination of Republicans and Democrats. The Democrats include John Hoadley of Kalamazoo. Often when we hear campaign reform or campaign finance reform type legislation come up, there seems to be one side or the other that thinks that they're going to lose an advantage if legislation is passed. Do the various lawmakers here seem to think that there is an advantage to be gained or lost here, or do they just simply see a system which they think has kind of spun a little bit out of control?
I think it's with this group of lawmakers, I think it's definitely the latter. From talking to them and knowing where some of these people stand, a lot of these are lawmakers who want to do what they feel is right. And they are not the ones who are looking for partisan advantage. Usually Representative Martin Horelak, who's the main sponsor here, he is from Southeast Michigan. He is often looking for reforms that he thinks is going to make the legislature kind of operate better. And I think that's what he's trying to do here. He's trying to fix something that he sees as a problem. He sees it as a problem that PACs have such a greater influence than constituents, and it's a problem he wants to take on. It's a fascinating proposal because Democrats take a lot of their, you know, Democrats are traditionally the people who are the ones pushing campaign finance reform in the legislature. I think it's interesting because cutting in half the amount that PACs can give could hurt Democrats. I mean, I don't think it's clear cut that this gives an advantage to one side or another. It's just a really interesting proposal that would likely take some money out of the political system. But then you have this whole other element of the political system where if you limit the amount that PACs can give directly to candidates, that money will likely find its way somewhere else. It could go into super PACs and be independent spending. It could become dark money and be given to nonprofits connected to lawmakers. So on its face, this bill would seem to take some money out of politics, but it could also just push the money elsewhere, which is another point to consider.
And that is a point I've heard people often raise about any effort at campaign finance reform is that the money will find another place to go and that the best thing that you can do is to try to bring more transparency so that there's less dark money. If the money's going to be spent, at least let us know who is spending it on what. Is there anything right now when you talk to lawmakers about trying to increase transparency, does that come up at all?
I mean, among some lawmakers, yes. I mean, there are lawmakers that care deeply about that. There are lawmakers who've put in bills to try to reach that goal of bringing more transparency to our electoral system in Michigan. I mean, it's important to note that Michigan is much different than other states at the level of dark money in our elections. And the level of contributions to nonprofits that happen, Michigan is different than other states. And there have been many studies done and reports done that says Michigan is really bad at this transparency and accountability element of our government. I don't think the issue gets the attention that it probably deserves in the legislature, but there are definitely some lawmakers who talk about it. It's definitely not an everyday conversation or a main focus of either caucus, I don't think.
On this particular legislation, which would limit the amounts that PACs could give to candidates, you just said a little bit ago that you did not think it was going to get a lot of traction in the legislature, despite the fact that it does have a group of bipartisan lawmakers sponsoring it. Why do you see it having a tough time?
Basically, the goal of this bill is to limit the influence of interest groups. And there aren't many things that would unite all of the interest groups in Lansing to be opposed to a bill, but I'm guessing just about every interest group that has a lobbyist up here in Lansing would be opposed to the idea of saying they can give less to candidates. So, I mean, basically you're going against the majority of the lobby corps. And also, campaigns cost money, and the people who run the campaigns need money to do their job, and I think they would say this may hinder our ability to get that money, so we're against it. I think that would be the argument. So those are the type of hurdles. And we just haven't seen from the legislature in all the years that I've been here. I covered the legislature for 4 years as a reporter. I've been in this job since the beginning of the year. There hasn't been a real effort to make any reforms to fix these types of things. So that's kind of why I say it's a major uphill battle.
Craig Mauger, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Craig Mauger is director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Links to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network's reports on the money raised by political action committees this election cycle and proposed legislation to limit contributions by PACs to political candidates can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.